The topic that we said for this session was like, what does the future hold? Okay, so we're trying to look forward. The first question, which is the first question we asked Jeffrey when we saw him last night, which is when's the RTM for server 2016? In which he said 2016. feel free to ask him that question again until he cracks. Because nothing's going to put WinOps on the map like getting the release date for 2016 announced at this conference. So really, just going to quickly go down the panel, get people to introduce themselves, and then just ask some general questions about what's the future of DevOps on Windows, the Windows Server estate, and then take any questions from you guys. If you ask a question, if you can sort of just put your hand up, I'll point you out, name, where you're from, ask your question. So we'll start with Richard, quick introduction.
Richard Sidaway, been around IT for more years than I care to remember. Done most things from development through to pure infrastructure.
It's also a PowerShell MVP, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm Mark Gray. I'm the PM owner on desired state configuration. I've been working on that for quite a while since the beginning of DSC. And prior to that, I was working on group policy. So
Okay, if he gets out of here alive, you guys are just not doing your job properly.
Haven't heard that response before. I've heard anger, but not laughter.
And I'm Jeffrey Snover. We met before.
I'm Chris O'Dell. I'm a developer on the platform engineering team and a little free book. There's none left, I'm afraid. You weren't quick enough. Co-authored with Matthew Skelton of Skelton Thatcher Consulting.
Michael Green. I'm a PM on the CAT team for Windows Server and Enterprise Cloud Engineering. And thanks for all the tweets.
Cool. Well, I'll kick off a question. What do you see as the most exciting thing looking forward in the Windows DevOps world? What's something you're personally genuinely excited about?
Yeah. I would have to say the community involvement. We've done, from a PowerShell and a DSC perspective, we've created the platform, and the things that are coming out of the community at this point are just, I mean, the speed that they're coming out and what they're doing is just, it really excites me, because it's, the ball is moving and it's just going to go faster and faster and faster, so it's just fun to see.
So quick question for you guys. Who here contributes to Windows open source projects? Okay, we've got to change that. Okay. Sorry? That's right. You should all stop right away. No, let's get more of you contributing. So, Jeffrey, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's the architectural re-architecture of Windows Server that we talked about earlier. You know, I started at Microsoft, about 16 years ago, and I did not come to work at Microsoft because I loved Windows. That was not the deal. In fact, that was actually not the case. I came to Microsoft to turn Windows into something that I really loved and respected, and Windows Server 2016 really is that. We're laying the foundation, the architectural foundation. Windows Server 2016 is the largest architectural change we've had of the server since really NT, really it is. And so it lays the architectural foundation for the next 10, 15, 20 years for, what we call a cloud-paced world, and that's what I'm the most excited about. I'm very enthusiastic. I think you're going to see the architectural investments that we've made in this release are just going to bear fruit and allow the community to contribute and for us all to move farther, faster, in a better way. So I'm very excited about that.
Chris, you're a practitioner. You're out there doing this in the real world.
Yes.
And writing books about O'Reilly for it. They're not quite the same thing. But
I'm a developer. I'm not really from the server side. So although Windows Nano is exciting, I'm actually more interested in .NET Core and all that kind of stuff, so kind of unshackling .NET from Windows. So, yeah, that's for me.
I'm right there with Mark, and the only thing that I would add is I think at PowerShell Summit this year, I think across the past few summits, we've seen, this transition from these two groups, meaning a product team and customers, towards it's just us, right? And that cultural or attitude change is really phenomenal to watch, and it was really, really felt at this year's summit. which was pretty great.
Richard?
I think the biggest thing for me is the is NanoServer and containers and the way that they actually shrink the server, in inverted commas, part of the equation, and it puts the emphasis where it belongs on the applications, mm-hmm. because that's what brings the money in for companies. Spinning up a server doesn't bring money in. Spinning up an application, that's what brings the money in.
Okay, I'm going to throw one more in just from my point of view, and that's Azure Stack. So on-premise Azure, because I think that for a lot of you, for a lot of the enterprise companies that I've worked in the past, they keep having all these reasons why they don't go to a cloud. And I think Azure Stack is going to sell like hotcakes because it'll give... Suddenly, they don't have any excuse anymore. I can use an ARM template on my Azure Stack in-premise, and I can use an ARM template on my Azure Stack in the cloud. And it, once you've got that kind of transportability, then somebody's going to say, why am I running all these servers in-premise? So I think that creating an on-ramp is going to be really exciting. So questions. Has anybody got a question? I mean, yeah, great. Fire away.
Chris. Someone's an ops. Even though, like you said, there's no ops, I guess what you're saying is there's no one in that role of ops. But the skills and the knowledge and the responsibility has to go somewhere.
I guess eventually the whole ops movement will probably be commoditized, which means the provider will probably be affecting, hence Lambda or function.
Okay, there's still other parts that you need to be aware of, I suppose, the metrics and whether the app is working in a way that you're expecting. You can't farm that off to AWS, you still have to operate it in some way, ensure it's doing the right thing. I see what you're saying, there'll be less of that if we go down serverless. So I suppose the skills will go more towards whether the app is doing the right thing.
So is everybody familiar with the emerging serverless paradigm? So things like Azure Functions, which were launched at Build, and AWS Lambda, sort of another evolution of PaaS, really. So, I mean, thoughts about serverless and Lambda and PaaS? Anyone?
There's a server under there somewhere.
Okay. It's all somebody else's computer.
Somebody will be managing that somewhere. They're never, ever just going to be a bubble in the middle of the air all by themselves. There is something underneath there. Now, whether that is up in the cloud and it's somebody else managing it, or whether it's you're managing it on-prem, it is going to be there.
Yeah, you know, the joke about no ops is that no ops is what developers think of until they get the pager going off at 3 a.m. And then all of a sudden they think DevOps is a pretty good idea. What I'd say is that we are in a time of great change. We're in a time of great change. And I will tell you that anybody that tells you with high degree of precision about what the future is going to look like 3 or 5 years out is full of nonsense. That's nonsense. In a time of great change, it's even hard to figure out the next steps and the step after that. You know, 4 or 5 years out, you're just not going to know. So jobs will be changing, job responsibilities will be changing, but how they change, we don't really know. Yeah, so I just say that. So, you know, it is a time to invest in your career, to keep your eye on the ball. What is the ball? The ball is value delivery to customers, yeah. Right? Some people like to, you know, what's DevOps? It's continuous integration. It's blah, blah, blah. Those are techniques. Those are techniques. They're great techniques. There's some good. There's some bad. Those are techniques. What matters is value delivery to customers. Are you figuring out what your customers need? Are you able to respond to that quickly and faster than the other guy, right? And if you, the folks who get that right are the folks who are going to gain a sustainable competitive advantage and prosper. And whether you call yourself a dev or an op or whatever, all that's going to, we'll see how it all nets out. But that's the ball. That's the prize.
So the question for Mark, you made this point about community earlier, I guess. So in a time of great change right now, if you were sort of giving a message to the community, where would you say skills have to go? What would you, what's something that somebody can take away? Where would you, if you walked out of here and you said, actually, I really want to get into this stuff, where would you start?
I would start just from the, I think the similar question was asked in another panel on skills to build. I think Git is one of the first things that I would go into if I started to do that, build and learn how Git works and source control and a lot of that kind of stuff. Because if you're going to start contributing to like PowerShell resources and stuff like that, or DSC resources. You need to know Git to do that. Obviously, you need to know PowerShell as well, but you need to really start to understand how that stuff works. So.
You know, a long time ago when I started PowerShell, we started off with the principle that said, I know that your hair's on fire, and the last thing you want to do is to invest in learning a new skill. And I make the following commitment to you. I want you to do that. I want you to stop doing what you're doing, learn PowerShell, and I will make the personal commitment to make sure that that was the best investment you ever made. And how was I going to do that? And the answer is, as new things came up, we would use the skills and technologies that you used, that you learned, over and over and over again, right? That's why we got hardcore about verbs. You learn those set of verbs, they're going to apply. They're going to apply across SQL and Exchange and IIS, et cetera. And so you see, as we've done, switched from a general purpose scripting language and now got into solving specific management problems, I've maintained that promise. As we do configuration, you use your PowerShell skills to do configuration. As you do testing, use your PowerShell skills using PESTER and operational validation testing. Again, PowerShell skills to do that. When you want to secure your environment, use Jia, which again leverages your PowerShell skills. So I'd say invest in PowerShell. That's a set of skills that we're committed to making sure are the best investment you ever made.
Question? Yeah. Mike, you want to take that one? Because your boss handed you the microphone.
So ultimately, whenever the business comes back to him and says, why aren't you able to meet our demands? He's going to have some tough answers, tough questions to answer. And it's kind of like I was saying earlier where, you know, it's funny how the same manager will say, I'm going to cut the budget on this project, so we're going to not write test code. But then when there's an outage, they ask, how do we make sure this never happens again? So to me, that's it. And part of it is, are you enabling them to go to their business partners and reevaluate the value proposition? We've been talking about that for like 15 or 20 years now. Like, how do we not just be a cost center? But the Phoenix project just hit home so hard for me, and that was one of the big concepts there is whenever he sits down, and I think he actually goes to a sales manager and says, you know, I want to talk to you about how to make you more successful. And I forget the line in the book, but it's along the lines of like, oh, well, you know, my workstation had like an email error yesterday. My printer doesn't work right or something. And he's like, no. That's not what I'm talking about when I say IT value, right? What would make it easier for you as a business person here to be successful? And then they have this big conversation, and it changes everything. And they actually become cohorts and go lead like this secret project, you know, and push it through. And that kind of stuff just happens all the time. But it's going to those business leaders and figuring out, you know, when I say IT value proposition, what does that really mean?
But we all have this desire that at some point some enlightened executive's going to get it, and they're going to mandate this change, and it's going to come on down, and everything's going to be good. We have seen that that's not the way it happens. At best, you'll get somebody who does get it, and they will act as a sponsor for a small project. But invariably, there is a successful pattern that you want to follow. The successful pattern is start small. Have a small, well-defined project and a group of, you know, the coalition of the willing, people who want to do this, enthusiastic, and you go do a small thing and you're successful with it and you work out the details. Now look, DevOps, there's lots of practices, lots of procedures, but the reality is you got to make it your own. Each company has their own culture and unique set of constraints, so you got to figure out how to take those practices and thoughts and make them specific to your culture and your constraints. But then you have a win, and then you do it again, and you broaden and you broaden. So a couple years ago, I went to the DevOps Enterprise Conference, a bunch of people talk about their experience, very interesting. The next year, I went to the same conference, same people, telling roughly similar stories. There's a big difference. big difference was almost invariable, all the people that were there last year had bigger jobs responsible for more things. Why? Because they had been successful and they were given more influence and more power. Look, as an executive, what you just dream for is to find the spark. And when you find the spark, you want to pour gasoline on it, right? And make it bigger. So, you know, the spark, but very few of the executives have the spark themselves. That's got to come from the people themselves.
I think if you're pitching to IT managers, the fact that the processes that you're putting in will take mistakes out of the organization, because that's the one thing that IT managers hate being kicked for. And if you can show them how you can stop making the same mistake over and over again, you've got a winner.
Chris?
One of the things that I would add to that is visibility. With DevOps, you have source control and all that stuff where you check source in, and when something goes wrong, the executives come to you and go, what went wrong? Before you have DevOps, it's like, I don't know, let me run some scripts and figure out what changed on my environment. When you have DevOps working with source control and all that kind of stuff, you do a diff on the source that changed, and you know exactly what changed, and you can roll back or whatever. So it does make the meantime to recover a lot quicker as well. So,
Chris?
Yeah. Your question's quite loaded, I suppose, because your CTO is asking for something he doesn't understand, so I suppose I would ask...
Oh, hypothetically.
No, I know you're saying hypothetically, but the next question to that is basically getting them to define what that means to them, because...
I guess that was my second question, the subtext of the question.
Yeah.
DevOps means many things to many people.
Exactly, so how does he define success? What would it mean to be DevOps?
So the question... I'm an IT contractor. I work in various places. It ranges from people that come purely from a development background and kind of get the agile movement to people who come predominantly from the infrastructure movement and think that DevOps may be automation and scripting the infrastructure as it stands today. And so the question is, we want to do DevOps, but no, you just want to do automation of what you're doing currently. DevOps is something else that is the collaboration between development and infrastructure.
Okay.
And so it's perhaps trying to get that message to the CTO who may or may not think it's one thing or the other.
Cool. I think you've just come up with really great examples. Well done.
I think it was a good message from the DevOps Enterprise Summit last year. One of the blogs that summarized things was one of the biggest messages was it's got to be bottom up and top down at the same time. If you don't have engineers who are lighting the spark, as to use your analogy, and if you don't have senior executives that are pouring the fuel on top, it'll peter out, because an engineering-led change can't go outside of its silo. It'll change that one team, but then it goes to the next team, and the next team goes, well, you're not in my organization line, so therefore I'm going to ignore you. And if it's completely top-down, then the engineers sit there and go, oh, I'm being forced to learn something new again. You know, I'm being changed. I'm having change done to me again. You know, and you get massive resistance. So, yeah, I mean, I really like that. Light the spark, pull the gasoline. Top, bottom up and top down at the same time.
But if I were to precisely answer the question and in the elevator, I'd say DevOps is about shifting the mindset of IT from keeping the lights on and trying to save money to a growth-oriented mindset where we can use IT to deliver customer value and make lots of money.
Okay. Got a question? I think you're dangerously going down the path of bimodal IT there, which will get you thrown out of this conference.
Well, what I wanted to do is to throw that idea over and say,
is DevOps
something that you can bring to what's in place already?
Is DevOps only just for new? Or is it...
new.
Okay. Richard? Mark? Go for it.
In many respects, it is for new, because if you... if your server's up and running and your application's not going to be touched and all you're doing is patching it, you've got a very small part of the DevOps processes that are going to touch that box. It's when you get to change that system for whatever reason that you need to start bringing the DevOps processes and practices and principles in.
I would just clarify that it's the key thing there is change. You don't have to have a greenfield environment to use it. It's more of a introduce the processes when a change is going to happen to a system. It's a system that there, it's been running, but no system is there without changes. So you introduce this process into small changes. I'm going to deploy an update on that system, so I'll use the DevOps process for this update, or I need to deploy a new version of an application or something like that. It's the small things like that where you can introduce it. It's not, I'm going to define a DSC configuration for everything on that box. I mean, that's not going to happen overnight. It's something that I need to change something on that box, so I'm going to do that for that. So.
I was going to, mine's gone blank.
No, go ahead. Okay, well, I'll say, you know, it's absolutely true. You know, green fields, it's easier to do things than stuff that you already exists. Let me give you a concrete example. For years now, I have said that I wanted to open source PowerShell, okay? And I predicted that we would. And the reality is that there's a big challenge to that. Why? And the answer is, well, it's part of the Windows build system. The Windows build system is an engineering system built to one of the largest engineering processes ever seen by mankind. And that build system is almost like, tied to the foundations of the building, right? In order to have an open source project, people have to be able to build things and they have to be able to test it. Well, our build and test things are very Microsoft specific and sort of not joking. They are almost tied to the specific buildings at Microsoft. So you can't do that. So what have we done? Well, if you've seen, what you've seen is that PowerShell, what we've done is we've open sourced new things. All of our desired state configuration resources are open and community sourced. As we now just recently, a couple weeks ago, started to open source a couple of the commandlets. So these are sort of the greenfield things, and then all of a sudden we do that, and wow, we're getting some great contributions, and that provides some more motivation to see, hey, can we do more and more? And the reality is, yeah, then trying to apply some of these things to the stuff that already exists, it's a big challenge. But if you can start with these greenfield things and see the success, that creates the motivation to want to have more and more and increases the willingness to go invest in those hard things. I mean, sometimes it's just hard lifting. You know, we often talk about these, grand visions, and often it's like just the grinds, right? Just got a ton of code and I just got to grind it from here to there. And that's hard for people to do unless they can see the path to demonstrated success. Do you remember what you were thinking?
Yeah, I do know. Okay, right. In a panel downstairs about culture, I've forgotten the lady's name, but she said about legacy.
Yeah.
And the fact that it isn't legacy because this thing is running, it's making money and keeping the lights on. So you may be difficult to get DevOps kind of things into the things that are legacy. But it's probably worth it. Those stuff is keeping your company going. I mean, I wouldn't use it to learn how to do it. I mean, that would be greenfield, so you can get, now you know, you're like, yeah, I'm DevOps. But then you take that effort and you push it into those legacy apps because, yeah, they're keeping everything running for you, making you money.
I think, yes, your first toe in the water, DevOps, trying to automate a legacy system. I mean, we did some stuff for a customer which was basically an Oracle retail, system. And, I mean, it was the most, and it was owned by somebody else, a product that'd been acquired by Oracle. And trying to automate this was just really, really painful. But we did it, and the outcome for the customer was massive. You know, they'd gone from originally 9-month cycle times to 6-month cycle times to 1-month cycle times, from taking a 2-week test cycle was now 40 minutes, and the impact that had. So, I mean, you can, I defy you to find a product that you can't do a DevOps approach to in both a technical way and a non-technical way. It can be done, but it's painful, and you don't start with, well, in many ways, you want to start with the most painful thing, but don't start with something to give you the quick win. to kindle. You don't dump a whole log on the spark straight away. You kindle it gently. Yeah, this analogy is going to run, guys.
That's good. I like it. I will say that in the DevOps community, right, there's lots of interesting debates and conversations. One I don't think has gotten enough conversation, enough airing, is the question mark around done. Are you ever done? Are there ever applications like when clearly the DevOps, the thing where it's really important is for those things that are never done. You're delivering a service and you're constantly listening to your customers and you're changing. And this is an ongoing concern. But are there ever pieces of software where you invest in it, you get it to a certain level, and then you're done? And I'll assert a whole bunch of enterprises have a bunch of code that's done. And the question is, well, what's the role of DevOps for software that will have a doneness to them? And anyway, that's an interesting topic. I don't think it's gotten enough.
That's another whole presentation.
Yeah.
So another question? So, yep. Oh, no. Oh, do you want to stay with this topic? Yep. Jump in, Mike.
Well, there's only one thing. So we touched on this a couple of times. So what's the key skill set? You know, kind of what are the big problems to solve? And we touched on this on the white paper a little bit. I really think the next hero role is the architect that just understands how to go through the transition. I mean, we've had periods of time throughout our careers where there were major transitions in technology before, and the people who came out of it with the most senior titles and, you know, the most interesting consulting jobs or the most interesting projects to work on, whatever gets you out of bed in the morning, were the people who didn't wait for the how-to paper. They looked at what was in front of them, and they tried to figure it out, and they didn't get it right the first time, and then they tried again, and they eventually figured out a pattern that works. Because every customer that I've talked to is different. Yeah. So there's no clear getting started guide other than you're going to want to try to use some of these tools and some of these and make some investments here, and that's what the hero role is going to end up being.
Cool. Question? So, yep. Who wants to kick off?
Well, one is not bringing teams together.
Yeah.
So as an example, if the server team tries to take this on by themselves, and then, you know, they're not working together with application teams, so what are they really testing? You know, we're testing the infrastructure changes. Well, are you testing it against the application owner's code or just, you know, what you know about it and things like that? And then you'll have the security team come along and recognize a zero day and just decide to slam some change into production and not. Everything's got to go back to the top of the funnel. So everything that's going to go into production has got to go back up to the top, pass all the tests by the application owner, the operations owner, everything like that, and that's all got to be automated. And then you can safely go into production with confidence. And whenever it's these isolated teams, then you can really get yourself in trouble.
Underestimating how much an office environment can reduce the collaboration between teams, walls, doors, floors.
Wow. I think that a common thing is trying to go too far too fast. You know, often people like, we're going to be DevOps, and then just kind of jam it down and then, you know, go too, you know, too big. And that often fails. Or people who want to go to no ops, oh, we'll just get rid of the operations people, have developers. You're just kind of going too far, too fast. The answer is you want to apply the first DevOps principle to adopting DevOps. The first DevOps principle is do small batches. Do small batches and focus in on the frequency instead of one big batch. So apply that same principle to DevOps. Start with a small project. Start and not try and solve everything first. Hey, can I get all my artifacts in source code? Oh, great. You know, then the next thing, and then the next thing. So again, whatever your small step is, that's fine. But don't go do the big bang. That's invariably a path to failure. often it's an active conversation as to whether or not you ever declare anybody a DevOps engineer. A lot of people think that as soon as you've done that, that's the kiss of death. You know, I don't know. I don't have an opinion on that. But that's one of the thoughts, you know, that you really want to just bring the people together and not have the DevOps team that's imposing DevOps artificially onto other teams.
Mark, Richard?
I think I would say the most important thing is to make sure the first thing you do, you know you can succeed at. Because if you fail, you have an incredible uphill battle. So pick some, as Jeffrey said, pick something small, pick something that you know you can deliver, and make sure that you live up to the promise of that delivery, and then you start to build confidence in your management that you can do what you say you can do.
Mark, anything to add? No?
I'll throw one more thing on here. Mark and I had an awesome experience with the customer. I can't say who it was, but we sat down. Some of our most just amazing experiences are whenever we go sit down with somebody outside of Microsoft and we say, you know, we're going to lock ourselves in a room and we're not coming out till we figure out how this is going to work. So in this case, it was what's minimum viable product for DSC to go through a pipeline? And fortunately, they had great DevOps coaches and that already had an established practice, and they were just bringing us in to kind of work through what's this look like with DSC and Windows. So you start with the Kanban board, and we said, okay, what's MVP? And it was shocking for us how low that MVP baseline was. I mean, we started off like, okay, we're going to have, you know, this going to source control, it's going to have these things, and they would just start writing things on, you know, post-it notes and sticking them in backlog.
Yep. We're like,
which of these are we going to work on? They're like, you haven't even gotten close to MVP yet. And, you know, we got all the way down to like, you've got, you know, just the configuration and you're going to make changes to it. And the build script's going to do like 1/10 of what it's eventually going to do. And then we're going to manually copy and paste it over to the pull server and verify this thing's working. Well, that doesn't even seem like it's minimum viable. It's certainly not minimum valuable, right? And they're like, doesn't matter. You just get the minimum thing to work. And then we'll go to these post-its and they'll become work in progress. And it was just like, okay, you know, great. Now we get where we've got to start whenever you're looking at digesting. I think it's like, how do you eat the elephant kind of conversation.
Yeah, you know, Mark and I were at DevOps Days Seattle a couple weeks ago, and the guy was making exactly that point. He says, think about the smallest change you can make, the smallest measurable change you can make. He says, that's probably 10 times too big. You go even smaller. Just do that smallest thing. And that was a great, great mindset.
So we had some questions over there. Sorry, there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We, you know, the sea refuses no river, right? So in the context, Azure is the sea, right? We're going to take workloads, wherever those workloads are, be they Linux workloads or Windows workloads, we're going to be the best platform to do that. Now, that said, the foundation of Azure is Windows Server, okay? So we're going to continue to make Windows Server be a great platform to run Azure and be a great fabric for Azure for your virtualization, for your cloud environments. And then we're also going to continue to invest to make it a great guest of those environments, right? So the whole investment around NanoServer, the whole investment around .NET Core, we're going to invest to make those, you know, runtime applications run great on Windows. So, you know, definitely we will continue to compete in the guest application space. You know, I talked to the CTO of Chef a while ago, and he was talking about a customer who was saying, oh, you know, they loved Linux. But, you know, these configuration files, you know, the problem with those configuration files is there's no schema to it, and if you get it wrong, everything goes wrong, you know, and you can't really tell. Wouldn't it be great if we had an API that enforced the schema? And the CTO of Chef said, yeah, that's called Windows. And so the answer is that both these applications have advantages and disadvantages. By the way, that was what the guy called it, his crying game moment. Anyway, so each one of these OSs has their advantages and disadvantages. We think Windows is a great operating system, and we're going to optimize it and do a great job. I mean, clearly we've got fantastic SDKs, great APIs. You know, look, the reality is, let's think about this, right? So Windows NT and Linux started about the same time. Linux was an environment that was consistent with the dominant server model, this APIs and way of managing things, and Windows was a radical departure from that. Linux and Windows both ran on PC Economics hardware, and Linux was free and Windows was expensive, okay? And yet, year after year after year, Windows has been the dominant operating system. This year, I forget the exact numbers, but probably 6 or 70% of all servers that will be running in the world will be running Windows, not Linux. So it is a very successful operating system, despite some of the disadvantages that I mentioned in my earlier talk today. And then we're addressing those disadvantages. So we are very bullish on the future of Windows. Now, if you choose to support Linux, I'm personally investing to make sure that that's a great experience on our virtualization environment. It will be the best place to run Linux workloads, full stop. We're investing to make sure that you can consume as much Linux and Windows as you want. That's why I'm investing to take desired state configuration and bring it on Linux. That's why we've open sourced OMI, the equivalent of WMI for Linux. So we'll continue to invest in. But Windows by far has a great future ahead of it.
Turn around, we've got one last question. Peter wanted. We'll take two. We'll take the guy in the front, and then Peter can do the final question, as he often does. So how long will Microsoft keep releasing Windows Server editions for on-premise workloads? So really, you're asking, how quickly do you think everything is going to move to the cloud?
Oh, I think on-premise is a very healthy future. I mean, I think the cloud. Look, here's the thing. I think people get this wrong. They think of it as a replacement model, right? Oh, there's 100% of things, and 100% is going to go from here to there. I don't see it that way at all. What I see is that the cloud is this vast accelerator, right? And whether that's cloud and public cloud or private cloud, I think that when we get the cloud economics right, when we get the cloud operating system model right, when we get the DevOps model right, the demand for computing is just going to go through the roof.
Yeah.
And a bunch of that's going to be satisfied by the public cloud, a bunch of people for whatever reasons, data sovereignty reasons, control reasons, or just because, darn it, I want to, are going to run things on premises. So I see that going on forever.
Mark, Mike, anyone? No? Okay. I'll grab the last question before we start to wrap up.
What's the most entertaining thing you've learned during an outage?
What's the most entertaining thing you've learned during an outage?
How quick it is to wind up your manager.
Yeah, I was going to say, how quickly Satya Nadella finds out about these things. It's truly stunning.
Chris?
Probably that it was my fault.
Mike?
My favorite one, this is from 15 plus years ago, back whenever I was a consultant working at a hospital, and tickets came in and said, the network is slower when it rains. That's no way that's true. It turned out that there was a water leak in one of the closets, and something was actually shorting something out, and then somebody was resetting it, or who knows how it was recovering eventually, but it wasn't totally a lie. So who knows?
Actually, that does remind me of one. So I once was doing, a long time ago, supporting a hospital as they took our beta test software, and then it should not have been deployed, but it was, and then it went out, and I had to stitch together all the database records as they were trying to bring these people admit them into the hospital. Harrowing experience. So the thing I learned was, boy, there are an amazing number of gunshot wounds in Memphis, Tennessee.
Right. Mark, my final words, we got one last outage story.
I'm actually thinking way back as well, and I'm trying to figure out how to say this, but there was a circumstance where my manager, I was an IT pro at the time, and we had one server rack in our server room, and I walked behind the server rack at one point and tripped over the power cord. Server was down, and just the way my manager described it was our outing was due to some Mark tripping over the power cable.
One last thing from personal experience. Don't say how much you enjoyed your holiday when there was an outage while you were away.
And on that note, thank you to our panel.